Today is the 4th of July, 2020. This is part 16 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Charles Butch Farabee, spelled F-A-R-A-B-E-E. My name is Tom Martin. Hey, Butch, good afternoon. How are you? Happy 4th of July.
Well, happy 4th of July to you. And, Tom, I give you full permission to use this talk today.
Come on, we'll keep working on this. It's to record this oral history over the phone. Thank you. You're working on it. Eventually, by the time we're all done, you'll have it. You'll have the drill memorized.
Yeah, I'll have about the six words memorized.
Exactly right. Thank you very much. In our last interview, you ran through the 1986 mid-air collision between a tourist helicopter and a tourist fixed-wing aircraft. But we were talking later after the interview, and it sounds like you got involved with the issue of overflights over Grand Canyon earlier than that. Could you head in that direction now?
Okay, so this is the way I remember it. You know, as the in charge of the flying program or the aviation program for the Park Service. You know, the helicopter and the fixed wing contract, which meant that I then had to establish relationships with Grand Canyon Helicopters. Hold on. Grand Canyon Helicopters, Grand Canyon Airlines, the flight tower, the aircraft, you know, air traffic control tower.
Okay.
And other people and entities within the aviation community at the South Rim, particularly. So, you know, in that job, but also, you know, I became, either I was told to do this or I took it upon myself, and I can't recall which, started documenting the various flights within the, below the rim, other than tour. Types. In this case, it would be mostly military, not always, but mostly.
Okay.
And including some pretty large aircraft, you know, not only military jets, but also just military four-engine, not so much bombers, but tankers that people would get photos of or they'd be reported And somehow I became sort of a natural funnel for some of this information. Some of the photos would come through me. And over time, I ended up collecting, you know, a number of photos of these airplanes. I know I made, you know, a number of phone calls to Nellis Air Force Base in Las Vegas to talk to them, you know, the... not so much the, you know, not the traffic controllers, but just the flight managers, you know, some colonel or some lieutenant colonel, probably.
Right. And were they sympathetic?
Yeah, they seemed to be. I mean, at least they played me, you know, they paid lip service. And I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt and just say that they actually were concerned, partially because of, you know, the complaint. They didn't need to have civilians like myself representing the National Park Service and agency and the park itself complaining about aircraft, their aircraft within the park.
That makes sense.
So, and that also, I suspect that from a selfish standpoint, you know, they didn't want their pilots to end up hitting a wall either.
Right. Hey, Butch, can I jump in here? Because I've never really seen this. Since, you know, early before 86, what sort of commercial helicopter and fixed wing activity was happening below the rim at the time?
Well, there were, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how many fixed wing operators there were out of Las Vegas.
Well, no, I guess as a Johnny come lately, if you will, somebody who came in after the 1986 changes, rule changes to stop flying below the rim. That's all I've ever seen and known.
Yeah.
So the tours, the normal tours, fixed wings from Vegas and helicopters from the South Rim, were they like, you know, down around Phantom Ranch or Hans Rapid?
They weren't buzzing Phantom Ranch, but they were well below the rim.
Okay.
The upper rim.
Okay.
I don't know, you know, how often, probably not that often, did they ever get into the inner gorge. Perhaps they did on occasion.
Okay.
But it wouldn't be unusual at all for a fixed wing or a helicopter to be below the rim. And, you know, technically, you know, the Park Service didn't have any control over it.
Right.
You know, the only control would have been the FAA. And, of course, you know, for early on in the process of these, you know, when we first started documenting the noise intrusion stuff, yeah, actually, Tom, I forgot what I was saying.
Well, you know, what I was thinking was, isn't there a 500-foot elevation over people and structures? But if there are no people and structures, it's reasonable and prudent.
That's correct. You're 100% correct. And I guess that's what I was going to say, although I forgot.
Okay. Well, yeah, it sounded like you were heading in that direction. And,
well, I was.
Which means that, hey, you know, if I can fly 50 feet over the Tonto platform, and there's nobody there, you know, that's reasonable and prudent.
Well, and I think that, you know, some of these pilots, and they basically were nice guys.
Yeah, sure.
But they, but some of them would come and go. I mean, it wasn't like some of them stayed for years. And we got to know them pretty well, and in fact, for the helicopter, some of them flew for us.
Right.
But for others, it was really a, you know, a fill-in job for 2 months kind of a thing.
Kind of fill in your logbook sort of thing, get some hours?
Yeah, or, you know, that the helicopter companies might have been shorthanded for some reason.
Okay.
So, or things got super busy, they just needed more people.
Right.
And I don't know the community enough to know how they were to, you know, would get these guys to show up, but they would. So there was, you know, a full spectrum of interest by the pilots. I mean, some of them were very concerned, and some of them probably could have cared less.
Were they coming to you with concerns about near misses, or what kind of concerns did they have?
Well, no, they weren't coming to me for concerns. Did I say that? I'm not so sure.
I missed that. I misunderstood. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, if I did, I should not have said it quite that way anyway. Well, the concerns I had, of course, were all the other planes, and partially because, you know, of the air traffic. You know, my job was search and rescue and emergency operations and the flying, the Park Service aspect of flying.
Mm-hmm.
So, which meant that I was concerned about mid-air collisions. This is before the 1986 collision.
Uh-huh.
But I was concerned about wrecks and, you know, that sort of thing, which is one of the reasons I was trying to get a handle on who was doing the flying, particularly the Nellis Air Force guys.
Okay.
And, you know, there was a, you know, an unofficial, but a pretty well documented, anecdotally at least, patch, sort of, you know, that's figuratively speaking a patch, for flying below the rim if you're a jet pilot flying out of Nellis. I mean, that was the same thing is true in Death Valley. If you flew below sea level in Death Valley, you were part of a sea, you know, below sea level group.
Oh, so you would get a patch for your flight
suit. Well, I say figuratively.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Not literally, but you know, that was a you know, mark of airmanship and bravado and whatever else it takes, probably stupidity. So, you know, but I, so I was concerned about, you know, wrecks and mid-air collisions and all that sort of thing.
Right.
And I wasn't necessarily focused on the other concerns, which was mostly visual intrusion and noise intrusion and harm to any number of things with the environment, like the landing of the bighorn sheep, the fragility of some of the Indian ruins, perhaps, you know, that, or the peregrine falcons, I think, if I remember right. So, you know, that wasn't necessarily my thing. My thing was really the accidents, actually.
Okay.
But in the middle of, the, you know, roughly the summer, maybe even the spring of 85, I was brought in by the superintendent, and there was a, you know, sort of an informal working group, mostly with the recent... Sorry about that.
No worries.
Charging my phone right now.
Yeah.
And so this was, I think initially it was an informal group. It was John Miller, Rick Erdenwine, Steve Hodapp, H-O-D-A-P-P, was the chief of resources at the time. And they, the resource guys, acquired some, you know, devices to measure sound, both the ambient sound as well as sound of the helicopters and the flights in general.
Okay.
So I participated in a number of those listening sessions. We go out on some point between, actually several different points between... the village, the South Rim Village and Desert View, and the resource guys principally had places that they wanted to check out.
Okay.
It wasn't anything I chose, but, you know, I'd go along, one, just out of the sake of interest, to maybe learn how to use the devices and whatever, but also just, to, I guess, to get some handle on what's the big deal here, you know, what's the concern. Because I'd spent a lot of time hiking in the park, but as a pilot, as a fixed-wing pilot, although admittedly, you know, not a very good fixed-wing pilot, and a short time, or not very much time, you know, the noise wasn't that much of a thing to me.
Okay.
So, but we'd go out and we'd measure the sound, and I think... there was some sort of rhyme or reason. I mean, I think there was some sort of a schedule, like, you know, between, and I'm making this totally up, but just as an example, between, say, 10 in the morning and noon, and then 2 in the afternoon to 3, you know, on every other day, or, you know, some sort of schedule that they could come up with a pattern, perhaps. So they did that, and I tagged along mostly. I wasn't leading the charge on any of this.
Okay. And these machines would pick up any aircraft noise. I mean, basically there would be a baseline of natural quiet. And then, you know, when a plane flew over, whether it was a tourist plane or a general aviation plane or a commercial airline or a military flight, all of these would tag the machine.
Well, yeah, within reason.
Yeah.
I mean, if you were at 40,000 feet, it might not. But
okay.
It was a way to try to get our little finger into the pie here.
Okay.
And get some sense on data, because we were getting all this anecdotal things from the Sierra Club and from, I don't know, the Grand Canyon Trust and probably others,
uh-huh,
about, you know, maybe their constituents, their membership were complaining, and, you know, as part of their position to document and try to curb impacts to the various parks and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And this was one issue that over time had been building. And as I say, anecdotally, there were lots of reports of planes and helicopters within the park, or, you know, over the park or within the rims of the park.
Okay.
And one of the things I used to laugh at, and I had to put out some information, was because the rangers now, you know, the field rangers, and more particularly the people that were in the Inner Canyon, the backcountry patrolmen and perhaps the river people, if a helicopter or a plane was in the area, they would report it as violating something, right? Then, you know, I'd have to explain to them, just as you did a few minutes ago, about the 500 feet. I said, you know, they can fly right now. There's no law that says that they can't fly and literally be 5 feet above the Tonneau Plateau,
mm-hmm,
as long as they're not endangering other people and or structures, as you say. So, but I would, you know, that was a reoccurring occasion for me, would be to, you know, you could hear somebody on the radio, rather, reporting, you know, this will be, you know, 301, there's a plane flying over the rim going, you know, east to west or something.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it does sound like this was normal flying operations for the,
yeah,
for the commercial people, would be to head down into the inner gorge, at least top of the Tonto. I mean, right over the deck, that would be a pretty exciting flight, I'm sure.
Yeah, it would.
And if I was a ranger on patrol in the backcountry, I might call that in.
Yeah, well, and that's what they did.
Okay.
And I think the smaller, you know, the small six-place Cessnas were more apt to fly below the rim than the bigger ships, just because of the numbers of people, you know, the Twin Otters with 18 or 19 people on board.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, anecdotally, these things started coming to a head, and at some point, Dick Marks, perhaps with the concurrence or the push by Steve Hodapp, who was the chief of resources for the park, pulled together this informal, initially, group to sort of begin working on this, you know, document these things, you know, start getting some background noise information, get some information on the helicopters, you know, the noise for certain times, just that sort of thing. And as far as I know, that's how this entire issue started.
Okay.
Or, you know, that's how this group, that's how the Grand Canyon and then the NPS and then the Department of Interior and then the FAA and everybody and their brother finally got on board, is because of this little tiny effort that Dick Marks had initiated.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, if Steve Hodapp were here, and maybe Rick Earnenwine, they might have a slightly different take on some of this in terms of the timeline or whatever. But
uh-huh,
but as I remember it, that's the way it was. So the park put its head together, and this group became more formal. This committee became more formal. It was less, you know, less informal. And it consisted of Steve Hodapp. Marks was the head of the thing, although he wasn't necessarily at every little gathering.
Uh-huh.
So Dick Marks, and then Steve Hodapp was his chief of resources, who would be like his number two person in terms of this effort.
Okay.
Rick Earnenwine, who was a resource guy.
And how do you spell his last name?
Well, I think it's Ernewein. Ernewein. Rick Ernewein. And as it turns out, so over the years, he actually makes a career with the Park Service doing pretty much this sound stuff. He becomes like the sound guy for, I don't know if the entire Park Service, but much of the Park Service. I mean, he became the specialist.
Right.
And, you know, it's much more complicated than I know anything about. And so Rick ended up making the next, you know, 20 years plus, I think, specializing in this. So there was Rick, then John Miller, M-I-L-L-E-R, was a resource, you know, basic resource specialist for the park. And he ended up becoming my chief of resources when I was the superintendent of Padre Island, eventually.
Okay.
Then Mike Ebersole, E-B-E-R-S-O-L-E, Ebersole. Because, one, he was a, you know, relatively high-time fixed-wing pilot, was also very good friends with a lot of the aviation people out of Tuzian.
Okay.
I think we mentioned the other day about him starting a balloon business, balloon, you know, flying balloon across the canyon business.
And how did that work out for him? I've never talked with him about that.
Well, it didn't work out for him. And in generalities, he made one or two flights across, and there were a couple of other people that sort of bought into the business as well, you know, put in some money to buy a balloon or two.
Okay.
And it became one of the reasons it sort of went belly up pretty quickly is that, you know, the winds are too variable over the inner canyon. And so where are you going to land on the other side? It was easy to launch. It's harder to figure out where you're going to land and whether you're going to be able to have anybody pick you up.
Right.
You know, and, you know, which is easy if you're in, you know, Grants, New Mexico, probably. But, you know, on the north rim of the Grand Canyon, it's hard.
Mm, yeah.
So as a result of that, you know, they stopped the business pretty quickly. Now, I think that he ended up, in theory, still having the business for a couple of years. But from a practical standpoint, he did not do much of, you know, flying, at least not commercially anyway.
Mm.
So there's a, and so Mike Ebersole and myself, so however many people that is, five or six people were on this committee. And, you know, pretty quickly we started coming up with some alternatives, and they were put together in a document, and we actually went out to the public with five public meetings, public hearings, to get input. I mean, there was no decisions or anything made. It was just looking for input, but
right,
we had to start someplace. And so we ended up, you know, talking to our, you know, other groups. The Sierra Club would be one that would come to mind pretty quickly. National Parks and Conservation Association, I think.
Yep.
So we ended up getting, sending out notifications to a mailing list that was developed just to start getting some input. Now, I think in today's climate and the way things are organized, you know, we were pretty pretty elementary in what we were doing and how we were doing it, but we really didn't know what else to do at this point because it was such a novel issue that we were trying to undertake here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, also we're trying to learn, you know, is this a big deal or not? I mean, maybe we're making too much of it.
Uh-huh.
So we were trying to answer those kinds of questions, but we ended up going to, we had five public hearings or meetings. The first was in San Francisco.
Wow.
The second was in Las Vegas. The third was in Phoenix. And Governor Babbitt attended that one. That's the answer. So fourth was in Williams, Arizona, right outside the park.
Okay.
And Flagstaff was the last. And then there was an informal get-together, not quite as formal as the other five, at the Grand Canyon itself.
Okay.
Actually in the chapel, whatever, the Chapel of the Ages.
The Shrine, yeah, Shrine of the Ages.
Shrine of the Ages. So, at these meetings have been announced, and they were, we put them, you know, we put, and these, so these meetings were the end of October and like the second day of November.
Okay.
Of 1985.
Did anybody show up?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like an overwhelming standing room only kind of a crowd. Further away we got, you know, San Francisco, we did get, you know, probably a fair number, maybe 100 people showing up for, and most of them were probably Sierra Club types.
I was going to say, you know, you think Los Angeles might be closer, or Albuquerque, or Tucson, or Phoenix, but you were in Phoenix, that's right. So it's kind of surprising to see a meeting in San Francisco, but...
Well, yeah, I think part of it had to do with that. That's the regional office of the Parks.
Oh, okay.
And I think that had something to do with it, but I'm not really sure about that. And they were all pretty close together. A couple of things to mention along the way, which I thought was kind of... ironic or interesting, is at the second meeting, Halverson was there. What's his first name?
Elling?
Yeah, Elling. Elling Halverson was there. And it was, I'm trying to remember, I think it was like on a Saturday night, or it was in the evening anyway. And the next afternoon, like at 1 o'clock, I was supposed to chauffeur around, and not chauffeur, that's not the right term, act as tour guide for the Prince of Japan, who is now currently the Emperor of Japan, Naruhito. I think that's Naharito or something close to that. But you can just look under Emperor Japan, yeah, and you'll find him. And so I was supposed to do this. And so we ended up, or I ended up, and I think Dick came with me, flying back to Grand Canyon from Las Vegas on Halverson's plane, Grand Canyon Airlines, free. Because all of a sudden, you know, we were late, and the prince is showing up as well as some like honorary ambassador from San Francisco that was in his party.
Hmm.
So I asked Dick, I specifically said, you know, because I was really a little worried about the optics of this.
Yep.
But, you know, at the same time, we were sort of caught when, like, between a hard place and a rock, because I needed to be there at least to greet the prince. And you can go to the Arizona Republic and see the prince and I on the front page of the Sunday paper.
Hmm.
from the day before, so it must have been a Saturday. So it was a Sunday edition, which I didn't even know I was on the front page until I picked up my kids to take them away for a day or two. Hmm. And so that was kind of interesting. And of course, the touring the Prince around was interesting as well, but I'll come back to that at some point if you want. But
yeah.
But to stay with the Overfly parts, Las Vegas and Phoenix with Governor Babbitt, and I'm pretty sure John McCain showed up. Senator McCain was there as well, which is the only time I ever met him. So I'm pretty sure that was the same time. And then Phoenix, and then Flagstaff, and then Williams and Flagstaff.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing of interest from my perspective in terms of just these meetings was in Flagstaff. Up in front at the, we met at the government building there in Flagstaff, some big meeting room.
The federal building?
Well, I don't know if it's a federal building.
The FBI is in there. It's a 5-story building? Maybe not.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
By the library someplace.
Okay.
So, and I'm in the audience, and, I'm in my suit, and I don't have any real function there other than to, be a carry somebody's briefcase, basically. And we had some, demonstrators that were they weren't vocal. I mean, they weren't necessarily disturbing too much because we actually had a Flagstaff policeman, too. But one of the things that took place is one of the speakers who was dressed up in some sort of a costume, and what keeps running through my mind is like a nuclear, a robot kind of a nuclear person.
Oh, interesting.
But more interesting from my side was he pulls out a a king snake out of a pocket or out of his coat or something.
Okay.
And he's standing up in front, not intimidating, but, sort of waving it around over the, not the audience, but Dick Marks, Steve Hodapp, the regional director, Howard Chapman, Chapman, was up there as well. And he's sort of waving it around. And I spent, I took a number, three different courses on herpetology, advanced and advanced herpetology.
Okay.
So I was pretty comfortable around snakes. So pretty quickly, either I got a high sign from Dick Marks or maybe I just took it upon myself. But I went up. And I took the snake out of this guy's hand, and pretty gently. I mean, I'm pretty good with snakes. Had snakes in one hand, and I put this guy in an arm lock and escorted him down the aisle out to the front, outside the doors of the meeting room to a lobby of some sort, where the Flagstaff policeman met me. And he wanted to know if we wanted to pursue some sort of charge or something with this guy. And mm-hmm. I'm not exactly sure what would have been the charge, but my reaction was no. I mean, we don't want to do that. We just need to have this guy not be so, I guess sort of intimidating, if you will, with this snake. And if Mike Ebersole were in on this conversation, I'm sure, because he's mentioned it to me this several times, that that's one of the things in his mind's eye over the years that he recalls pretty clearly, was me doing this. But, you know, we would have, at Flagstaff as an example, we might have had 40 people in the audience. Most of them would have been anti-noise, anti-flying. But in Williams, a day or two before, it was like the other way. We had a fairly sizable group in support of the flying industry, the aviation industry, because that's a lot of their livelihood from a tourism standpoint is generated by, you know, aviation over the park.
And I'm going to step in and spell Elling, E-L-L-I-N-G, I think, Halvorsen, H-A-L-V-O-R-S-E-N, I believe.
Is that right, S-E-N?
Well, or is it S-O-N?
No, I think it's S-E-N.
Okay. And Elling had got the contract to construct the Trans Canyon Pipeline in the mid-1960s, and realized that he could start a helicopter or tourist business flying aircraft over the park, taking off outside park boundaries at the gateway community of Tucson. And that business exploded over 20 years between 1965 and 1985. And there you were. By the time the meetings rolled around into the early 1990s, Elling was taking big buses and loading them full of his employees and having them come to these meetings. Was there any sign that he was doing that there in 1985?
No, I don't remember any of that.
Okay.
No, I think it was still so grassroots and so at the beginning stages that, there's probably nothing, no concern on his part or the others of that, group. No, I mean, this is still pretty low-key. We're, in a fact-finding stage. In theory, we were going to the Park Service, but mostly the Grand Canyon National Park, probably with the support of the regional office, but not much beyond that, was going to make a finding of some sort. And I don't know what we ended up, what we were going to really do. But as we concluded those five meetings and we went back and, over the next several months, got together to figure out, where are we going from here? It became pretty obvious that this was actually a much bigger issue than we were giving it credence.
Interesting. Okay.
I mean, it just sort of, like an inverted pyramid. We started out at the tippy top of the, or bottom of the pyramid, whichever. And as we kept putting things together and having meetings and, getting letters and things from constituents and the Sierra Club people and stuff, it kept expanding.
Can we go back to optics for a minute? You mentioned the Prince of Japan flying in one of Elling Halvorsen's planes with you and...
No. I just met the Prince at the Alpha Var.
Oh, okay. So with Dick Marks?
Well, Dick and I flew back.
Okay.
Actually, I'm not, now that I think about it, I'm not sure that Dick flew back. I think he may have had, the superintendent's car. But since I was the one giving the tour, I'm pretty sure that I actually came back by myself.
Okay, well, no, the optics I was thinking about was the fact that the park was renting helicopters from Halvorsen for search and rescue and water pipeline work and all sorts of other things. So there was a well-established relationship with the helicopter operators outside the park. Clearly, there was a need for that type of equipment, and yet there were problems. You had mentioned in another interview about painting the tour helicopter from its normal orange color to a green color so people could identify that it was a National Park Service.
Yeah, that was, I found the date on that one.
Did you?
Yeah.
What was the date?
Well, it was May of 1985.
Okay, so this really was a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, if well before the 86 collision, you know, you were trying to solve problems just simply with paint. And that was working, I think.
Well, yeah, it was good.
Yeah. So I'm not surprised that this was a bigger issue than you had realized.
Well, the you know, these are all sort of taking place at the same time, you know, the meetings, which we had to set up a month or two in advance for sure anyway.
Yeah.
We're at the end of October. We were getting complaints from the general public about this helicopter landing at Phantom Ranch, and you know, some, there's probably some hyperbole attached to the complaints, but they were sufficient enough that we knew that, well, it's our helicopter. I mean, it's our, you know, our contract anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that, you know, when I went to, and I think it was Warren, you know, whoever the chief of operations for Grand Canyon Helicopter was at the time, they were very amenable, although it cost them a little money, they were very amenable to having that helicopter painted so that it became distinctive, so that they weren't continuing to get blamed. And rightfully so. I mean, mm-hmm. they should not have been blamed for us flying in with pipes or some sort of emergency or whatever.
Right, for general operations of Phantom Ranch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, plus we were below the rim, too.
Right. That's right.
And, you know, anybody that's hiking down the Bright Angel or the Kaibab, and who particularly are sensitive, or they've been reading their newsletter from their environmental group,
mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things they might want to easily do is complain about that helicopter flying across Plateau Point down to Phantom Ranch.
Right.
So it was good business on our part. It was good business on the Grand Canyon Helicopter's part to paint that thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was particularly proud of that. I thought that was pretty neat. It looked good.
Yeah.
It looked professional.
Still has a unique paint job today. It's a different type of helicopter with a different paint job, but
yeah, but
there it is, and you can identify it. You have the park ship right away.
Yeah,
it is not another
that's
one.
Important.
Yeah,
that really is important. You know, when you as an agency trying to promote the you know, the resources, protect the resources, and there you are, the biggest abuser. Meaning us, you know, the biggest abuser, although there were, you know, we could justify it. We were still creating noise and impact visually and whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know, then as the management assistant, once I took over that position, even though I still had search and rescue and fire, I sort of got out of the being too, you know, I didn't need to babysit too much the aviation aspect of that. I still remained in that working group. But as time went by, the working group responsibilities got bigger. The mission of the group became greater. And, you know, it sort of started taking on a life of its own, partly stuff that I really don't know too much about at this point now.
So the I'm assuming that the outcome, intended outcome, would have been a park overflights management plan. Or a park not the NPS operations, but sort of general aviation operations over the park. Was that the idea?
Well,
Or did it actually include, all right, this is what the park does with aircraft, And this is what tourists do with aircraft. This is what military does with aircraft. And was that?
I don't think, well, the military, we kind of painted out of the picture.
Okay.
I mean, after enough complaints to, a colonel down at Nellis Air Force Base, and I actually had his number and name. I could go directly to him rather than going to, like, their flight control or whatever. But, you know, that sort of wasn't too big an issue after a while.
Okay.
Although it was kind of fun along the way before I left, I know, there was this pretty impressive photo, and it turns out it was put on some calendars of the Blue Angels, the Navy's aerobatic team, you know, flying through the Grand Canyon below the rim. And, you know, from just a sheer visual, kind of impressive, today is the 4th of July, patriotic look. It was pretty impressive.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
You know, now, I mean, I guess if you were on the Plateau Point and those five or six jets come flying over, you know, that might be, for some of you, would be a little disconcerting, I suppose.
Yeah, the noise impact would be severe.
Yeah. It'd be pretty fast, and, you know, once you got off the ground, because you probably dropped to the ground, it'd be out of sight practically.
Right.
But it, the intent was to come up with something that was satisfactory for everybody. We were trying to accommodate the people on the ground, people that were in the air, you know, because there's a sizable community of people who can't hike, who can't ride a mule, who really don't want to go into the park, but they would like to see the park, just like the river runners, you know, or people that ride the rafts anyway. So we're trying to accommodate everybody, and, you know, I suspect over time we diluted our efforts to some degree. And after I left, I'm sure that it became more focused and more trying to actually take care of the resource more than the visitors or the people that wanted to fly and look and whatever.
So how did the air crash of 1986, as you talked about in the last interview, how did that impact this team and the plan they were working on?
Well, I mean, I think it's a great question, and I don't have a great answer. I don't even have a minor answer, really, I guess. It obviously had some impact. It was, you know, we as the park could point to this aha moment and say, well, see, that's what we're trying to avoid, everybody.
Right.
So I think last time I used the analogy or the whatever the right term is, nail in the coffin.
Right.
And I don't know if that's totally true, but it was impactful. And everybody, certainly the environmental people, could point to that and use it as a very visible, important reason for trying to have some control over this. Now, you know, the fixed wing and the helicopters, as a rule, pretty well adjusted themselves. I mean, they had a system down. They had some idea of which way they were going to go, and they were going to go, and again, I'm making this up, but maybe clockwise at a certain time, and would only go into certain parts of the near part of the Phantom Ranch, Supai, or a little Colorado area. So, they had some control over themselves internally. And I guess, you know, if they hadn't, there probably would have been more accidents or maybe an earlier accident.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there was one, I think it over time while I was there, of course, Grand Canyon Helicopters was the big player in the helicopter program, but there were a couple of smaller operations as well. And Papillon, P-A-P-I-L-L-I-O-N, Papillon, just like the book, right?
Yep.
Helicopters, which actually was pretty prominent in Hawaii, Hawaii Volcanoes.
And this is Elling Halvorsen's company as well, isn't it?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean,
eventually,
I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but they're a different color scheme. They're a different, you know, different group. I mean, mm-hmm. the pilots aren't interchangeable or anything. And I know that on one occasion, for sure, we ended up sighting them because they landed within the park at the Little Colorado Junction with the Colorado. And I think that they had been doing that. We had never heard. We didn't know about it. You know, no one really complained about it. But they actually had like a champagne flight where they would fly people in, land, put out a table, and I suspect, you know, chairs too, and, you know, have a little champagne lunch or something. You know, that was taking place for some period of, a short period of time, before we caught on to it, before anybody really said anything to us. And we sort of laid in wait for them to do that again, which somehow we found out about a schedule, and, you know, we were able to catch them there. So, I don't know, how did I get off on... You know, just the fact that the aviation group, the fixed wing and the helicopters, they sort of had adjusted their schedules and their areas that they would fly over internally. But that's what we were looking for as well. I mean, mm-hmm. how to do this. But the FAA the entire time at this point kept saying, you know, you guys don't have any real business doing any of this, except unless it either impacts the park, which we couldn't prove at the time, or actually we're landing in the park. And the FAA kept blowing its back on us. And I can't give you any real concrete examples other than telling you that, you know, for a number of years, you know, the Park Service was very secondary to the FAA. The FAA kept controlling, you know, everything. I mean, they're the ones that said, you know, we have the airspace is ours.
Right. This is a conflicting mandates from two government agencies. One agency, the Park Service, has to preserve unimpaired for future generations. That's a long-haul mission. And the FAA is about the promotion of aircraft safe, promotion of aircraft flight. Promotion right. means more, and to do it safely. So there's a conflict right there between these agencies.
Yeah, but, yes, you're 100% correct, but sort of the other side of that controversy also is that, you know, we as an agency did not have any way to document that it was impacting on the resource.
Okay.
You know, we had anecdotal stuff, but we didn't have enough anecdotal stuff. We didn't have enough details and enough data and enough listenings and enough peregrines harmed or whatever it might have been to get the attention of the FAA.
Right. Well, even if you did, even if you could show impairment on the ground, the FAA is still control of the sky, and they don't care about another agency's impairment.
No, that's right. Well, they didn't care anyway. I mean, they were friendly. It wasn't like they weren't friendly, but
right.
But they mostly said, hey, no, this is ours. You know, anything, you know, a foot off the ground all the way up to the moon is theirs.
Right.
And I don't know that they particularly said, get out of our way, but they did. They weren't all that cooperative either.
Well, this was where then, was it 1989? I'm trying to remember the year. Senator McCain's Overflights Act, which actually set then the flight ceilings at the rim or above.
Yeah, and I know that all took place. I was long gone at this point.
Okay.
Although, having said that, you know, my job in D.C. was the MPS aviation manager.
Okay.
But, you know, I had enough my hands full trying to just keep track of all these other balls, you know, including 25 planes, and two helicopters, and 35 pilots, as well as search and rescue and EMS and diving and incident command program, that I didn't pay much attention to that sort of thing. You know, it wasn't impacting me.
Right.
It wasn't something that I needed to be in the middle of. It wasn't that I wasn't concerned. It's just that there were a lot of other people, such as Rick Ernenwine and Steve Hodapp and some others, that were actually doing an excellent job. They didn't need me to muddy up any kind of waters. You know.
Right.
So.
And of course, you know, that Overflights Act had some Trojan horses in it as well. So and then of course McCain pulled out the high flyers. So the commercial airlines, their noise now doesn't count, and neither do the transport flights, what are called transport flights, which are often tours. So it's a really complex moving target game, if you will, between the people who would make a lot of money running these flights with a justification, as you point out. These people can't walk. They can't walk the trails. They don't have the time. Most of them are on a short time frame if they're doing the Western circuit of the parks. So, you know, versus the agency trying to preserve the natural quiet and the other resources of the park.
Well, but, you know, we would get people who would write in or who would testify or at least, you know, make a statement at these public hearings about all of the mule poop on the trails and the urine, which, you know, on a hot day, as you well know, I mean, the stench is really bad.
Pretty disgusting.
So, you know, there was always, well, what about these, you know, kinds of questions and things.
Right.
You know, now, you know, I need to make sure, I think I said like October and November, early November of 1985, but it might have been of 86. I need to sort of double check that somehow.
Okay. No worries. I mean, just
I can do that, but I can't do it right now.
Yeah, just putting in a point about it is clear.
Yeah, because
that you're not sure.
Well, because I do remember, I'm pretty sure that my touring the Prince around was in, you know, the end of October of 1986. And I'm like 99% sure that I went from Las Vegas aviation meeting, you know, to meet with the Prince. So if I said 85, I could easily be wrong on that. I have to double check on that.
Well, tell me about the Prince of Japan. What was that like?
Well, he was, I think, Oxford trained. He could speak better English than I can. Nice young guy. At that time, he was probably mid-20s, late-20s.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't married yet. He was accompanied by a whole raft, you know, 20 or 25 or more photographers and news people, mostly Japanese.
Okay.
Or at least that's who showed up anyway. And we had lunch at the Altavar. Then he and I and this honorary ambassador sat in the back, just the three of us, and there was a driver up in front. The three of us sat in the back of this really big stretch limousine, the biggest one I've ever been in. And I'm in full uniform, although not in, I don't have my Class A coat on because it's a little chilly, I think. And we spend, hour and a half or so driving around. I tell the driver where to go and, you know, where we're going to, you know, get out on some point, you know, Mather Point, and then we worked our way back along the rim towards Desert View. And when we got to the Yavapai Point, you know, the little Yavapai Museum,
yeah,
which we, you know, took a little tour in, and I probably had to fake my knowledge about the geology of the park at that point. But we went out on the point after, or, you know, out of the building and got out to a place where we could overlook everything. And so there are these 20 or 25 press people who all recognize, you know, the the prince and the family, the Japanese emperor's family is pretty, you know, sort of next to God in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm standing there, and the young man and myself, but I was probably like 40 at this point. I ended up putting my arm around on his shoulders. And It was sort of an instinctive thing on my part. It was just, sort of a friendship.
Yeah, like you might, you know, I can see you pointing with one hand and putting your other hand up on his shoulder. And
well, I put my arm all the way around his shoulder.
Oh.
And, like I'm his lifelong buddy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he smiled and everything was fine. And, you know, he didn't blink twice. But these 25
cameras,
press people behind me, there was this very audible gasp of me having done this and maybe even touching this guy.
Hmm.
And I remember that clearly. And I think that perhaps he was smiling at that, you know. It was like, you know, how absurd was this? But, we spent another, total perhaps an hour and a half or so driving around and looking. But we had lunch before that as well. And then I think he flew over to Las Vegas. That was part of his tour. So, I found him to be very nice.
Fun.
But I did get a very nice gift. I got a nice letter from the superintendent got a very nice letter in thanking me for all the stuff that we did for him, which wasn't much other than rolling out the red carpet for an hour, a couple hours maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And but I got the insignia or the emblem or the logo or the representation of the throne, the Japanese throne, is a chrysanthemum.
Oh.
So they sent me a very nice, which I still have, a very nice tie clip. Now, which doesn't go very well with my t-shirts, but, you know, I've got this nice gift from the, you know, I suspect he did not pick it out personally.
Mm-hmm.
But, the Japanese government did send me a nice letter through the superintendent thanking me, as well as this chrysanthemum tie tack, or not tie tack, but tie clip. So, other than that, I don't have too much to say. I sort of followed him, you know, I read about him. I don't know if I saw anything on TV or anything, but read about him getting married, and they you know, that was quite a big thing for the Japanese people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. And he's now the emperor. So
fun.
I don't think he might remember the tour, but he doesn't remember me. Sure, right?
The perks of the job.
Well, it was kind of fun. I mean, it's, you know, something I can tell my kids. And
yeah. Yeah.
And speaking, so the unfortunately, I've met, you know, a lot of my peers have met presidents and vice presidents and stuff, and I never did any of that, but I did meet the president of West Germany. My position as a management assistant.
Was that Chancellor Kohl? I'm trying to remember.
No,
who.
It was a guy by the name of, he's a doctor, and Carstens, C-A-R-S-T-E-N-S, I think Carl, K-A-R-L. Now, Kohl was a chancellor, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, this is
but he may have been, I don't know.
Well, I don't know.
Later, yeah. No, I'm not sure.
I have a hard time remembering all of our presidents, let alone West German presidents. So, but I don't have much more to say about the prince anyway.
Okay. How was it that you came to leave Grand Canyon?
Well, I was the management assistant. I had SAR. I had FIRE. I was raising two boys by myself, basically. And I'd been at the park for 6 years. And one day I get a flyer or an announcement, not so much a flyer, but an announcement on my desk, put there anonymously, announcing a job in Washington, D.C., a promotion, a GS-13, because I was a GS-12 at the Canyon. Announcing a thing called the Emergency Services Coordinator. And the guy that was running, that was like the chief ranger of the Park Service, was a very good friend of mine, Walt Dabney, D-A-B-N-E-Y, Walter Dabney, who worked for me in Yosemite. And he and I would climb together and run together and bike together, and we're excellent friends and still are.
Cool.
So, but Walter was the chief ranger. I get this announcement on my desk, which I ignore. I don't, you know, I'm really not interested. It's, you know, why do I want to move to Washington, D.C.? I'm perfectly happy out in the West where the mountains are and all that sort of thing.
Right.
And,
I mean, you're from the West. You're not, you know, D.C., nope. Savvy very much at all.
Nope. And I ignore it I read it, I suspect, but I don't apply. I'm not really too interested. I probably didn't even talk to anybody about it. And the job closed. I mean, you know, the announcement, the expiration time on you have to apply by a certain time, kind of, and that came and went, and I hadn't applied. And I've never asked Walter about this, but I think he wanted me to come back there. Or they didn't get whoever they wanted to apply, or, you know. So they refly the announcement. I mean, they put the announcement back out again. Same job description, same requirements, same responsibilities, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And this time I actually sort of sit up and take notice and say, well, okay, you know, maybe, because I probably actually started paying attention to it. And I thought, well, you know, I mean, it's a totally different thing. And one of the reasons, there's a, in the back of every ranger's mind, at least for a long time, is they did not want to go to a central office, like a regional office, a job, you know,
right,
a desk job, and certainly would not want to go to Washington, D.C. for a couple of reasons. One, most of my peers would be afraid that they would be stuck there. And, you know, I thought about that, and this is the honest to God truth, and I've told this little moral 100 times to various people, that if I couldn't get out of there at a certain point, then I didn't deserve to get out of there. I mean, that's the way I looked at it. And I applied, got the job, had to go back there in, I can't remember, it might have been, well, I can't remember, it was like the end of the summer, I mean the end of the school year, close to the end of the school year, I think.
So in the winter of 86, 87?
No, probably applied then, but...
Or the spring of 87.
No, it was the spring of 87 is when,
okay,
I went back there. And I have to look up the actual enter on duty date, EOD date. Actually, that's redundant, enter on duty. No. Anyway, but it was close to the end of the school year, which my kids were at the Grand Canyon school.
Okay.
And their mother lived in Flagstaff, and she would be taking them for the summer anyway. So, you know, it gave me a chance to get back to D.C. and get my feet on the ground. And even though it was terribly hot and humid, and I really wasn't sort of prepared for that. I wasn't, the heat wasn't a big deal. But like they say in Tucson, it's, you know, it's a dry heat.
Yep.
Well, it's not a dry heat in Washington, D.C. at all.
Nope.
So, and, you know, and at the time, while I was doing that job, and afterwards, I have always thought that was the best job I had in the Park Service.
Really?
Yep.
So I'm just thinking, let me look at the time here, because we've been at this an hour 12. The next question I've got is, well, I'll ask this, because I think we'll wrap this up then. Washington, D.C. doesn't have search and rescues. It doesn't have plane crashes. It doesn't have high water dam failures. It doesn't have people falling off of cliffs and all of the myriad of search and rescue activities that Grand Canyon and Yosemite have. So this would have been a huge, well, certainly it was a step up pay grade wise, but it would have been a huge change for the types of things you were doing. Or exposed to. I mean, you're head of search and rescue, head of structural fire. You're not going to be doing any of that in D.C.
Well, it was a leap of faith for me.
Okay.
You know, the job entailed overall responsibility, I guess, for search and rescue, EMS, you know, emergency medical system programs, diving, aviation, health and fitness, which ends up taking half of my time over, as it turns out, the incident command program, and lifeguards, which I pretty much never did anything with.
I mean, to be fair, that fairly complex and extensive list you just went through, you could do all that stuff in your sleep. So what more better person to write policies and procedures in Washington, D.C. for that type of activity across the agency?
Well, I appreciate the confidence that you've given to me on that one, but, you know, I had a pretty good handle on it. But, you know, at a national level, you know, I could focus on, you know, I was pretty good about going over a cliff and getting somebody or making an arrest. But, you know, at a national level, you got to deal with 50 different states and other entities and other agencies and, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Hmm.
So it was a real challenge. And I think part of that, that's what made it so much fun, for one thing. But it was also that I had my finger in so many different pies at a level where I could actually make a contribution. And my boss, my good friend Walt Dabney, and I, who also, he only lived a mile away from me, out by Dulles Airport, he and I agreed right off the bat that technically we work for the director and the secretary's office, but in reality, our heart is working for a GS-7, GS-9 field ranger. That's who we want to respond to. That's who we want to take care of. We weren't, at least, I mean, and I'm not speaking for Walter, although I probably could, but in my case, you know, I didn't, you know, I knew that I had to satisfy the director and the secretary, which, you know, I would do on numerous occasions, actually. But I also knew that, you know, in that job, and then in the ranger activities, which is what this whole group was called, and there were about 10 of us, I suppose, total, that our mission was to help make the field ranger or the ranger activities, you know, in the parks easier and safer and more efficient. Walter, even we all worked in one corridor of the main interior building in D.C., and Walter had a sign made that he put up over the beginning of that corridor, which is only about 10 or 12 offices. What have you done for your parks today? That was his mantra, and he and I were terribly simpatico on that, trying to get those things done. But we also knew on many occasions when we would be running, literally, jogging anyway, down the hall to get to the secretary's office or to the director's office to put out some brush fire or to respond to some issue. But in the back of our mind, we wanted to help the ranger in the field. That was our real mission. And I enjoyed that. And as I say, I mean, you know, it was an adrenaline in a different kind of a way. I wasn't rappelling 2,000 feet. You know, I could still occasionally go out and do stuff, you know, make aviation reviews and that sort of thing. But mostly I was a desk jockey.
You know what? Let's call it here, and next time we meet, let's talk about your time in Washington, D.C., because I would like to know more about that. And how,
okay.
Certainly how it relates to the parks back home that you cut your teeth in, as they say.
Yeah, there's one, you know, I would like to sort of briefly mention a minor thing, but about the Grand Canyon, maybe actually one or two other things. But one was the caves at the Grand Canyon. And my helping orchestrate, one guy in particular who I befriended after I arrested him to help out with the cave program at the Grand Canyon as a volunteer.
I want that story. So I've written that down, and So we'll go back and I definitely want that story too. Then we'll spend some more time in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
Great. With that, this will conclude part 16 of Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Butch Farabee. Today is July 4th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin, and Butch, happy 4th of July.
Well, you too. You too. Thank you.
Thank you.